Welcome to health policy and the future of the American healthcare system. We have two things coming around. One of them is a release for videotaping. You can see the two cameras. We are videotaping this class for multiple reasons, the first reason of which is in case someone desperately gets ill and has to miss a class and has a reasonable excuse to miss a class. We'll get to attendance in a second. We're also going to be doing this class as part of Coursera, that online program. And we will edit what we have from these, but we need your consent for videotaping. So one of them is consent, and the other is the, I say final, in quotes, probably penultimate curriculum, because things are changing, and I'll explain why as we proceed. So, all of you, as part of this course, should have gotten clickers. Get your clickers out. Andrew, are you going to... Get your clickers out. And if you don't have clickers, I hope by the end I will persuade you need clickers for this class. We are going to be a very heavily interactive class. You will be participating in a whole series of different votes. So please, they're not that expensive. You can get... send them back. You can rent them.
So on the bottom left-hand side of the front face of your clicker, there's a button called Go or Channel. Depends on what model you have. Just click that button and very quickly hit the numbers 2 and 1 and then hit Go again. And that sets your channel to 21. We're always going to be on channel 21 in this classroom. And any clicker will do, as long as you get a response card RF. There are a couple different models, but they have them at the bookstore. So.
All right. So the first question, slide number 2 of the class. What is the tax exclusion in healthcare? A, is it a partial income tax exemption for Medicare recipients over age 65? Is it a loophole that allows healthcare technology investments to go untaxed? Is it a tax break for Medicaid recipients whose annual income is beneath the 80th percentile of the federal poverty line? Or D, an exemption from payroll and income tax on premiums for employer-based insurance? Please vote. A, B, C, or D? I hope we have more than 14 people who have clickers. If not, this is going to be a pretty boring class. Not working, huh? 15. All right. So 80% of you said it's an exemption from payroll income tax for employer-based insurance. Can someone explain to me what that means? Yeah.
That means that when your employer pays for the premiums for his employees for that insurance company, there's no income tax being placed on that for those premiums, nor on the employee.
So the employer doesn't pay, and the employee doesn't pay for taxes. In 2008, presidential election, which candidate for president was for eliminating the tax exclusion? Barack Obama, John McCain. We know we have at least 15. All right. That's an interesting pie, but I don't know what the percentages are. But most of you thought McCain, although a good portion of you thought Barack Obama. Here's a little clip from the campaign.
I'm Barack Obama, and I approve this message.
On health care, John McCain promises a tax credit. But here's what he won't tell you. McCain would impose a new tax on health benefits, taxing your health care for the first time ever. It's a multi-trillion-dollar tax hike, the largest middle-class tax increase in history. You won't find one word about it on his website, but the McCain tax could cost your family thousands. Can you afford it?
What was that ad about?
The fact that Senator McCain supported eliminating the tax exemption on employer and employee or employer provided health care.
Is it a new tax?
No, it's not.
It's an old tax?
The exemption has existed for a decade.
How many decades?
I believe for.
It's all right. That was a joke.
When was the tax exclusion established? 1929, 1933, 1954, 1980. You guys are getting shy. You're supposed to get looser as we go along. More votes. I scream, but I'm not sure how bad I bite. Although you'll find out. All right. I don't know where Mr. 15 went. 1954. What was happening in 1954 that we got a tax exclusion? What was happening in
1954?
Medicare, Medicaid, 1954? Who's president in
1954?
No, any Republican who would pass. Back there in the blue shirt, guy was looking what happened before. What was happening in 54?
Not too much.
Right. Eisenhower was president. What's happening in 1954? What?
The Korean War.
The Korean War. Over. Anyone else?
Desegregation.
Little early, Little Rock's 57,
the first Civil Rights Act passed in Congress is 57, this is early, we did desegregate under Truman, the armed forces, but this is not happening yet.
But why would desegregation influence or affect tax exclusion and tax policy for health care? What's happening in 54? Okay. During World War II, we had wage and price controls. Why did we have wage and price controls?
Well, we sent 17 million American boys overseas to fight in the war, and we had a severe shortage of people on the home front working. First time we had huge numbers of women in the paid workforce. Wages, as a consequence of a shortage of workers, were going up, huge upward pressure.
We needed every worker we can to fill the armament industry, whether it was tanks or airplanes or guns or bullets or even domestic front that we things we needed to keep the country going. Huge pressure on rising wages, led by the coal workers. They wanted a pay increase. These guys were working not 40 hours a week, but 50, 60, 70 hours a week, and they wanted more pay. But to prevent runaway inflation because of high wage demands, there was a cap, a freeze on wage and price increases. But to satisfy, again, especially the coal workers who threatened to go out on strike and were a key element of the Democratic Party, there was an agreement made that employers could offer health benefits to the workers up to 5% of wages, and that would not count as a violation of the wage and price freeze. So it was a way of saying, no, we're going to keep the freeze in place, But we are going to give you something for the first time. We're going to give you health insurance and not count it. But that didn't give them a tax exemption. That didn't lead to a tax exclusion. But after the war, you have this flood of people coming back, employment going up, and you have an expansion of employer-based coverage and health insurance gotten through your employer. In 1954, there was a revision to the Internal Revenue Code that the employer contribution, as was set up here, the employer contribution for health insurance were excluded from the employee's taxable income. So health insurance, therefore, became cheaper to give. Now, why would you do that? To go back to that question I asked. Why are you doing it? What?
Keep the workers happy.
Keep workers happy.
If workers are healthy, so they're more likely to work for a long period of time, and if they have coverage, then they...
All right, let's go back to basic economics. What do you do by giving a tax exclusion?
You want to increase health care coverage.
Good. And?
So you're encouraging more...
You're lowering the price that people are seeing for the health insurance. Right? And that'll shift and give you, encourage people, employers to adopt health insurance, encourage workers to demand health insurance. If you want employer-based coverage to proliferate, it's growing, but if you want it to proliferate more, you make the price lower. And one way of making the price lower is by giving a tax exclusion. All right? And that encourages employers to offer it. They don't pay taxes, as was mentioned. It encourages employees to demand it. They don't pay taxes on it. Everyone is happy. And the government's happy because people are getting insurance and the government isn't directly paying for it. It doesn't appear in the federal budget. So we don't get, God forbid, socialized medicine, right? What's happening right after the war in England? Anyone ever heard of the NHS, National Health Service? Right? When did Britain enact the NHS? Right after the war. The Labour government came in and enacted it. Why did they enact the National Health Service in Britain? Anyone? Payback! Okay? The British population suffered hugely during the war, both materially being deprived and having German bombs fall on them. This was payback to the population. They felt they were owed this. The United States did not go that route. We did not go government-supported health insurance. If you want to stay off that and you want government-supported health insurance to proliferate, if you don't want private insurance to proliferate, you do something like this. Now, the important thing about the tax exclusion is it definitely makes it cheaper. And because a dollar in your health insurance is worth more than a dollar in wages. Why is that? If you have the tax exclusion in place. Simple question, no tricks here.
As part of your wages would be taxed.
Right. If you get paid a dollar in wages, what happens? And do you ever look at your pay stub? You get pissed off, right? First thing that happens is, they told me I was going to earn $20,000 or a year, right? It's going to be $2,500 a month. Or $1,500 a month, $1,750, whatever the number is. And the first thing you see is take-home pay is $900. Where did all that other money go? But in terms of health insurance, is provided by the employer, you're not paying that tax. You're not paying the income tax. You're not paying the payroll tax. It's worth a real dollar to you. So it's actually worth more than that wage, because if you tried to go out and buy it, you would have to buy it in the private market with after-tax dollars. All right. Now we have an opinion question. Should we keep the tax exclusion in place or get rid of it? A, keep it. B, get rid of it. Only 14. Where did that 15th go? Someone's not voting. This is Chicago. You're supposed to vote early and often. So we're split two-thirds, one-third. Most want to get rid of it. Most want to keep it. Who wants to keep it? Why?
Because I think it will help provide more universal health care and will eliminate the self-selection bias.
Okay.
If you don't make health insurance mandatory, then only the people who are likely going to need it are going to opt in. That's going to make it more expensive for them.
So keeping the exclusion is a way of keeping people insured. Keeping people insured is a way of getting the healthy into the pool. Is that right?
Yes.
Okay. Anyone else for it for any other reason? Someone else? Yeah.
So it puts a higher tax burden on low-income workers because higher income people are more likely to pay the tax or be able to pay the tax, and if employers aren't providing their health insurance, then they may not have it at all.
Maybe I didn't understand you right, but you don't get this tax exclusion if you go into the individual market and buy health insurance. You only get it if your employer provides it.
Right, but your employer, if your employer has to pay the taxes, then they may be less likely to provide that insurance, and that's where most low-income employees get
Okay. So, as a matter of equity, it might be better to have the tax exclusion because then employers who have more low-income employees would retain their insurance. Who's for getting rid of it? Yeah.
Well, right now we're subsidizing people who are paying more for health insurance by giving them a larger tax credit. So basically, the more extravagant your plan, the more benefit you're getting from the government. And while there are regional differences, this does still go on and encourage excessive benefits, some might argue. Another problem.
So wait. Let's make sure everyone understands. So one problem is you encourage people to get higher and higher insurance. If in fact a dollar in health insurance is worth more than a dollar in income, you might have a preference for more health insurance. Therefore, I don't know exactly what you mean by extravagant health insurance, but more expensive health insurance. Okay. Other arguments? Yeah.
The tax exclusion ends up just being like a subsidy, so that it's inefficient and it could be used towards actually financing health reform. So
it sounds like you've got two arguments mixed in there. One is it's not the most efficient way of getting people insurance, and the second is it's a hell of a good revenue source if you want to finance health insurance. But what would you say to the lady behind you who said, well, a lot of people would lose coverage if you got rid of the tax exclusion, so it may be a good way of getting revenue, but if you're committed to universal coverage, you're going to just shovel it out the other door? Okay. Any other arguments for getting rid of the tax exclusion? Yeah.
The tax exclusion creates what you call job lock, where people don't change jobs because they want to retain their health insurance from their current job, and that leads to national economic inefficiencies because people aren't doing
this. Another inefficiency argument, right? So there are multiple inefficiency arguments, but at least one of them is this thing called job lock. If you've got health insurance, you might be loath to go to a job that doesn't have health insurance. You might even be loath to go to a job that does have health insurance but has a sort of 90-day waiting period where you might be uncovered and have to get it. Or you might be loath to start your own company because it's hard to get insurance. Which of the following families gets the most savings from the tax exclusion? A family of four making $279,000, a family of four making $78,000, a family of four making $43,000, or a family of four making $28,000. D. 25% of people thought family of four making $28,000. Most of you, two-thirds of you, thought family making $279,000. Those of you who thought A, why? Not same recidivist. Two-thirds of you. Good.
They're in a higher tax bracket than the difficulty of living.
Yeah. But if I'm paying $14,000, or if I'm getting a benefit that's worth, say, $10,000, how does that work?
So if you get a benefit, $10,000 will be taxed anyway, the higher tax bracket goes to 50% on that.
Close to 50%. What country are you living in? Are you in Denmark? This is the United States. We don't tax our rich people that much. You're paying 15% of capital gains. Right. But you're paying 35%. Let's be clear what the top bracket is in the United States. All right? 35% on the income tax.
Yeah. Right. So like I'm here, maybe it's a category of the money. I'm not going to throw them out of that, but...
Zero. Family of four at $28,000? You're paying zero. Okay? So, that's right. If you look at the data on who gets benefits from the tax exclusion, it doesn't go up to $279,000. But under 20,000 percent of, so you can see almost a third of workers are under 20,000. But the amount of the tax subsidy going to them is 5-6%. On the other hand, over 75,000, you can see, is about a quarter also of workers, but they're getting nearly 50% of the value of the tax exclusion credit. So it's biased, and you can see that most easily here. These data are a little old, but you can see that most easily here. Where we have a nice progression, this is done by the Lewin Consulting Group, a nice progression that as income increases to over $100,000, you can see very heavily skewed. What do we call that kind of stuff? What's the description for this phenomena where the rich are getting more money and the poor are getting less tax benefit? It's a regressive, right. Classically viewed as a regressive tax. So, it's for multiple reasons, lower income earners are less likely to have jobs that offer health coverage first. Why is that?
They're more likely to work on hourly jobs than they are to work in salary positions that offer benefits.
But even so, even if they work in salary jobs, why are they less likely to have health insurance?
They have less money overall, and health insurance is expensive.
Health insurance is expensive, and as a percentage, if it's a high percentage of the income you're earning, employers tend not to pay for that. They're already giving low wage for jobs. They're less likely to participate in employer-based coverage even when the employer offers it. Why is that? Typically, employers don't cover 100%. The worker has to take a part and pay a part of that premium. That costs a lot of money, discouraging lower income people from actually taking up the benefit. And then, as we pointed out, they're in a lower tax bracket, so the exemption actually provides them less dollars in return. A classic regressive situation. Here's another ad from our president. But in the campaign, pre-president.
John McCain talks about a $5,000 tax credit for health care. But here's what he's not telling you. McCain would make you pay income tax on your health insurance benefits. Taxing health benefits for the first time ever. And that tax credit? McCain's own website says it goes straight to the insurance companies, not to you, leaving you on your own to pay McCain's health insurance tax. Taxing health care instead of fixing it. We can't afford John McCain.
I'm Barack Obama, and I approve this message.
All right, here's a question for you.
Why was the president against repealing the tax exclusion and attacking John McCain for getting rid of the tax exclusion if the tax exclusion is regressive? And last I looked, the president is in the D column, not the R column.
It makes them popular with companies.
who are like want that tax benefit.
And he's trying to woo companies.
Yeah, and it also like he's playing to like people just don't understand necessarily what a tax does and just know that they don't want them. So it's just like, oh, you don't want taxes.
So he's playing on people's stupidity,
yeah.
And he's trying to woo employers.
Yeah.
Anyone else?
I'm not sure if I'm right. I kind of disagree with that. I think it was probably more likely had to do with the universal coverage that he was trying to provide and the dynamic we explored before, which was to eliminate the loophole. Healthcare coverage is going to likely drop as a percentage of the population.
And so you think that he was trying to protect poor people by keeping the tax exclusion in place?
I think in general he was trying to promote a dynamic where the system is set up in such a way that more people have coverage.
Right. We agree with that.
And that would go against that. Eliminating the loophole would go against that.
He's still incentivizing.
Who's he? McCain or Obama?
Obama would still be incentivizing more people exactly to be insured, the employers and the employees. So that's more people who are covered.
By keeping the employer, just by keeping the tax exclusion for health insurance, he would get the most people covered in the private sector, and he would figure out for those people who don't have coverage. So you think this was a way of retaining coverage? Yeah.
Even though the exemption is a regressive tax, by getting rid of it, the savings that the lower class have is a greater percentage of their income, of their household income. Therefore, it would be greater effective, you know, on a yearly basis rather than the rich who, even if they didn't have the savings, would still have a lot of their income after this lower percentage of the.
I'm not sure I understand, but let me try. What you're saying is, while it's a regressive tax, the rich certainly get more benefits. We go back to this slide. If you're in the, say, 20,000 to 30,000 rate and you're getting 725, that's a bigger percentage of your income, and so you're more grateful for it than if you're making over $100,000 and you're getting, you know, 3% of your income, and down here you're getting, you know, whatever, 4% of your income. Does that sound very plausible to anyone? So if we've got a regressive tax that's benefiting the rich, why is a Democratic president for it and spending, I might add, over $100 million bashing John McCain? He spent a huge amount of money on these ads. Yeah?
To gain universal health care, which is one of his biggest initiatives, he needed to get more people in the higher tax brackets on his side to say, don't worry, we won't change the status quo. And in order to do that, well, this is one of his mechanisms for that.
You think it was because he didn't want to rock the boat?
Yes.
So he was, again, someone over here is currying favor with business. You want to say he's currying favor with rich people, even though he's a Democrat?
Yeah, with
okay. The
end point of universal coverage.
He was trying to persuade the rich people that if we keep the tax exclusion, you get big benefits, we can get universal coverage all at the same time?
And it won't affect, and you'll be okay, because we won't change anything.
Is this like you can have your cake and not pay taxes too?
Yep.
maybe did some cost-benefit analysis and figured out that the number of people that drop out of getting health insurance as a result of not tax excluding it, well, is actually more than what he would actually end up covering because of the new Affordable Care Act. So he will end up, because people are dropping out and his mission is to get full coverage or universal coverage,
it'll be cheaper if we don't get rid of the tax exclusion to cover people. And if we got rid of the tax exclusion, it would be more expensive, and therefore keeping the tax exclusion is a better deal if you're trying to get the universal coverage. All right. Here are at least other options you might think of. Why did the president campaign on not eliminating tax exclusion? Labor likes the tax exclusion. People prefer greater health coverage to higher wages, just as a matter of preference, and so the exclusion reinforces their preference. So he could attack McCain for wanting to eliminate the exclusion and raise taxes. It was a good political ploy. The exclusion allows for expanded coverage. His liberal base was for the exclusion. Please vote. Come on, guys. guys, there are at least five of you who haven't voted. This isn't like, you know, we're not grading you. Although there are wrong answers here. So he could attack McCain on the raised taxes line. I guess cynicism is high here. His liberal base was for the exclusion. I don't actually know what the polling. Labor likes the tax exclusion. Only 7% of you thought that that was true. Who is those 7%? Yeah. Why did you say that?
So labor unions negotiate for wages and benefits for their employees, one of the largest benefits being health benefits. If employers were less likely to provide health benefits because the exclusion was either eliminated or capped, labor unions would lose one of their major bargaining chips for their employees, in turn losing whatever power they hold in terms of their membership, and labor unions are a fundamental piece of the Democratic coalition.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay. And why couldn't labor unions just say, all right, we're not going to negotiate for health insurance, we're going to negotiate for wages?
Well,
all right, but you know, maybe it's worth two-thirds of a wage. So instead of getting an added dollar, we're not giving you $1,000 increase in your health insurance. We're going to give you $700 increase in your wages. Is that worth that much less? I think a worker on the GM factory floor really wants that health insurance more than he wants the wage increase.
Well, I was just going to say it's much more risky for the employer, especially with those unions, and they're usually very physically intensive jobs. And if they're getting more wages, you might not.
If what you're saying is true from an employer standpoint, the health insurance is worth more, then why do you need to give an exclusion to encourage them to insure? I want to insure my worker because I want them to be healthy, to work on the job. I don't need the exclusion to give me an incentive. I already got the incentive, productivity.
I'm asking why labor's for it, not why the employer is for it. Why is labor for it? All right. Do people really prefer higher wages to higher income?
Yeah, I mean higher.
Higher health coverage to higher wages? Any of you take a job recently? You take a job recently? Ever had a job in your life? Would you have preferred another dollar in wages or $1.30 in insurance? Which would have been more valuable to you? Okay, so who of those 14% of people in this class who voted? Is that one person out of the 15 who voted? Raise your hand. All right.
Well, at least some of what you say is right. So the Commonwealth Fund is a healthcare foundation in New York, which has been very active advocating for universal healthcare coverage. And they, in the heat of the debate, put out a brief arguing for keeping the tax exclusion on several grounds. Here are some of their arguments. The current exemption represents a larger tax break as a percentage of income for low-income households with employer coverage, as was mentioned over here, and a smaller tax break for higher-income households. That is an argument they made. It is marginally true, but as we've noted, it is a classic regressive tax. And every economist will tell you, you know, you can look at the numbers as percentages and what the rich are still getting the huge benefit. The difference between a $725 benefit and a $2,700 benefit is $2,000 going to people making over $100,000. Now, maybe you are really concerned about percentages, but I think most people are concerned about dollars. Similarly, they argue, to avoid potentially undermining the current employer-sponsored pooled risk group coverage, any consideration of a cap would have to be combined with coverage for all, changes in insurance market rules, and shared responsibility of financing. So even if you're contemplating changing the tax exclusion, this relatively liberal foundation is like, don't go there unless you do all these other things. The president campaigned very, very hard. As I mentioned, $100 million on ads, exactly on the tax exclusion. This is a meeting in July 2009 where an argument was made to the president about why he should change his position. I happen to be sitting right there. I happen to be the guy making the argument. It was the argument. Everyone around that table could have made the argument. I happen to be the one who made the argument to the president. Think about what my argument was to the president. We're going to talk about the course logistics here. There are two of us teaching the course. I'm Zeke Emanuel. Sandy Schwartz, who has an appointment here in Wharton, as well as in the med school. Sandy, you want to stand up? That's not standing up, Sandy. That is waving your hand. we have some teaching assistants. Ellie Prager, who I don't see here. Nick Diamond. Katie Schumann, who's also not here. And Andrew Steinmetz, who was already talked to you, introduced. Will be helping out on logistics, grading, and other torture devices for you. I want to just go through the course outline so that you have a grasp as to what the flow of the course is. You have the syllabus in front of you. You can follow along. We're introducing the course today. Next week, we'll talk about the history of the American healthcare system and the structure of the system. Then we're going to talk about some of the problems of the system, the problem of cost, the problem of access, the problem of quality. We're going to talk about medical malpractice as well for those doctors or people sympathetic to doctors. Mark Pauly is going to come in and give us a guest lecture about moral hazard, adverse selection. We are going to have a presidential debate dinner, if I can fit it into my travel schedule, so that the first debate in Denver, Colorado, is about healthcare, and we are going to have a dinner digesting and dissecting that debate. We're then going to have a presentation on some other non-American healthcare systems. We are going to have a panel of practicing physicians giving you their view of what the benefits and tortures of working in the current healthcare system are like. We're going to talk about what was on the table as alternative strategies for reforming the system. And then we're going to go into the Affordable Care Act, the road that led up to it, the impact on access, quality, and cost, as well as other important activities. Things like the impact on the delivery system, comparative effectiveness evaluations, the impact on the insurance industry, the impact on innovation and technology, the impact on hospitals, the effect on employers and workers. I'm going to tell you a little bit about how healthcare reform got done, various insider views of trade-offs that were made. We have a special speaker who's not on the regular class flow because she couldn't get here during our class times, Annie Lamont. She is the number one female venture capitalist in the healthcare space in the country, probably the world. She will be coming down to us from Greenwich to talk about how she views investments in the healthcare space now in light of the Affordable Care Act. So we're going to have two different views about investing on the innovation and healthcare system side. We're then going to have a guest lecturer from the law school, Ted Ruger, talk about how he reads the Supreme Court decision. We're going to talk about the future, controlling costs in the future. We have a number of guest lecturers here. Mark Pauly, who you guys well know here, one of the leading health economists in the world, fortunately here at Penn, is going to talk to us, as I mentioned, about adverse selection and moral hazard. Julia Lynch, who's on our political science faculty and studies comparative health systems, is going to talk to us. We have three doctors, a pediatrician, internal medicine physician, and an oncologist from the community. He'll talk and answer your questions about what it's like to practice so you have a view from the inside. Bob Kocher, one of my colleagues from the National Economic Council, previously a McKinsey consultant and now a venture capitalist based in Palo Alto with Venrock, makes a lot of investments on innovation in the healthcare space, is going to talk to you about how he sees the Affordable Care Act and investment. Vivian Reifberg is a senior partner at McKinsey in Washington, D.C., and one of the real experts on the health insurance industry. And she's going to talk to you about how the Affordable Care Act is going to affect insurance companies. Ralph Muller runs the UPenn Health System. He's going to talk to you about how he sees it. Mark Duggan, another professor here, who worked at the Council of Economic Advisers during healthcare reform, with me, is going to talk about the effect on workers. Ted Ruger, as I mentioned, and Annie Lamont. Now, Sandy and I have five rules. To be honest, they're my rules, and Sandy has signed on to them. First is, we expect you to attend the class. We understand that some things come up. You get sick. You might perforate an ulcer. You might get hit by a car. We understand. We expect you in class, nonetheless. I don't know why you would pay thousands of dollars to take a class and not attend a class, but we expect you to be punctual. We will begin at 4:30. My watch is set by the satellites up there. We will begin at 4:30. We are going to have quizzes at the start of class. You want to maximize your time on the quizzes? I would be punctual. No cell phones in this class, no PDAs, no smartphones. I hear one go off. I will ask you to leave. I will ask you to turn them off, please, for the hour and a half per session we're here. It's not going to kill you. If you're expecting a call from the president, I understand. You can leave your phone on. Okay? I just got a call from the mayor of Chicago, who I happen to know. But you notice I didn't take it. A number of you have your notebooks and computers open. Fine for taking notes. That's great. If I find that you're Googling, Facebooking, emailing, dawdling as we walk around, I will ask you to leave the class. We want you to be attending the class, not attending somewhere else. We would also ask that you not blog about the class. You're not here to be a critic or a spokesperson for the world. We want you to talk in the class. And last, we would hope that you would do the reading. We have spent a lot of time perfecting this reading. Doesn't mean it's perfect, but we have thought about the readings, and we think that they're valuable. We have also made a valiant effort to keep the reading at a reasonable amount. Not every week can that be true. We also are informed on our thinking about teaching by three important pieces of data. We are, after all, here in Wharton, and data counts. Sandy and I are data-driven guys, and one of the data pieces we know is you guys don't work hard enough. The average student at a four-year college today spends less than 15 hours a week studying. Right? Not my data. This is research. Right? And by the way, that's gone down over time. All right? Down, decrease. Right? When Sandy was in school, way back here, right? You know?
Absolutely.
They worked hard.
They're laughing, but it's true.
Yeah. They worked hard. Almost 40 hours studying outside of class. I'm not that old, right? I went to school somewhere here. Right? We worked hard. You guys are way down here. You're not working hard enough anymore. Right? That's me. Studying for an organic chemistry test. We worked hard. We absorbed it while we were sleeping. That's me in my office in the science center. That's no joke. Right? So, we don't want to hear there's too much work in this class. Okay? The decline by Babcock and Marks, that Babcock and Marks found, infects students of all demographics. No matter the student's major, gender, race, no matter the size of the school, the quality of the SAT scores of the people enrolled there, the results are the same. Students of all ability levels are studying less. It's not just limited to bad schools, Babcock said. We're seeing it at liberal arts colleges, doctoral research colleges, master's colleges, every different type, different size. It's just across the spectrum. It's very robust. This is just a huge change in every category. I'm not making this up. All right. That's the first piece of information. Work hard. We expect it. We're from the old school, and Sandy's from the ancient school. Second, we will have quizzes in this class every week. Not every class, but every week. That's not because we believe in torture, right? We don't believe in torture. We're against waterboarding. Quizzes are not torture. In fact, quizzes are learning devices. So if you look at the data, right, you actually retain more if you're quizzed. Every time you test someone, you change what they know, and it actually means you change it for the positive, that they're able to learn more and retain it. And here's the surprising fact. A powerful way of improving one's memory for material is to be tested on that material. Tests enhance later retention more than additional study of the material. Even when tests are given without feedback, when we don't give you the grades back. So if you actually take people and you say, study the material over and over again, they spend a lot of hours. You say, study the material, I'm going to test you. They spend less time. Turns out that when they get tested, they actually learn more, even though they're spending less time at it. And they learn more even if they never get the answers back. Really, really interesting data. Why is that? Anyone have any suspicions about why that might be true? Why does testing improve your retention?
It holds you accountable for the knowledge.
No.
Asking you to reduce what you've learned actually improve your learning versus fast.
Why? That's just the data. Why?
Because
you have your hand up?
You have to manipulate the data in your mind.
Right! Right! Testing is not a dipstick. It doesn't just stick it in there and find out what the level is. When you have to answer a question, you actually have to use this noggin. Right? And that stupid line, you know, your brain's like a muscle, the more you exercise it, the better it gets. It turns out it's actually true. You have to manipulate information. You have to recall information. The brain is working. And you know the way neurons work? They make connections to other neurons. They make those connections. If you don't use those connections, they atrophy. If you use those connections, they get strengthened. Using the information through testing actually enhances your learning. Ergo, here's our grading system. In-class quizzes, worth 15%, will drop the lowest in case you had a bad day the night before. There will be 3 homework assignments. You'll see over the course, we're going to ask you to go shop for insurance on the Massachusetts Exchange and to report back what you bought, for example. We will have several other of those types of assignments. We hope that they're enjoyable or not. We're going to have 1 midterm exam and 1 in-class final that's cumulative over the whole course. Any questions about that so far? All right. Yes, quizzes. So once a week, 3 questions, multiple choice, based on the readings and topics covered in the previous week lecture. They'll be given at the beginning of class, 10 minutes, collect it, don't open your computers until the quiz is over. Okay? Here's a sample question. In the period from 1941 to 43, the U.S. limited the use of penicillin to the military, which rationed the drug among soldiers who were ill. Which of the following military personnel would have received priority? This is from one of my other classes. I'm not giving you away what we're going to ask you next week. All right? So, you get the flavor. Anyone have any idea what the right answer here is? Yeah. B, soldiers with clap. Yes, those are the guys who got priority for penicillin. You figure it out. Okay? Last thing. Sandy and I are nervous. We are concerned, just like you're concerned about the grade at the end of the year. We're concerned about our grades at the end of the year. All right? It turns out that your evaluations of faculty depend upon our appearance and beauty. And you know why now immediately that Sandy and I are worried. It turns out that instructors who are viewed as better looking receive higher instructional ratings from students. Again, these are just data. All I'm telling you is the real facts of the world. It turns out, however, that this correlation is true only for male instructors. This is why Sandy and I are really worried. Right? So if you actually look at people, and they graded 100 different faculty pictures on beauty scores. They had lots of students grading them. And then they looked at their course evaluations. Look at what you get. It really increases depending on how people independently value. That's the Wall Street Journal editorial page calling back. All right? It's really true. There's the other problem. You guys are laughing. That is who it is. That non-tenure track faculty receive higher teacher evaluations than tenured faculty. All right? Now, you can see why Sandy and I are nervous. Right? We're male. We're tenured. And we have this looks problem. Okay? So, you know, be nice to us. All right, let's get back to some substance. Unless someone has a question about the course and the course requirements. Everything fine? Everything clear? No one has any problems with that? Yeah.
For the courses that are changed from Tuesday to Monday, if we have a conflict with that, talk to a TA or...
Yeah, you can talk to Andrew. We'll make suitable accommodations. You couldn't be responsible for that. This course has been incredibly difficult for us. Partially for my travel schedule, partially for Sandy's travel schedule, partially to get some people like Annie Lamont in. You know, her schedule is just unbelievably difficult to manage. Yeah, and we do have that problem of Jewish holidays. Yeah?
Who should we contact if that's an issue?
This guy, Andrew. Okay? Anything else? So what happened with the tax exclusion? What would you have said to the President of the United States in that room, sitting with him? It's a nice Friday afternoon. You can see the sun coming through. It's about 3:30 in the afternoon. You have the President. You're sitting among, I don't know, there are 7 or 8 of us in that room, all health policy wonks, all talking about the same damn thing. What would you have told the President to do with the tax exclusion? Nothing? You have a minute of the President. It's very valuable. More valuable than anything else you've ever done. What do you tell the President? What do you tell the President? Do you tell him to keep the exclusion or not? No, what do you tell them?
I'm going to go with...
What do you tell the President? He's just spent $100 million on bashing McCain about the tax exclusion. And he won!
Yeah, I would tell him to stick with
it. Stick with the tax exclusion. And why would you tell him that?
Again, for the same reason that some of the other people were mentioning, just kind of not rocking the boat at the current time period.
Okay, you want to get the universal coverage, Mr. President? You want employers to keep it? Let's keep the tax exclusion in place, and we'll have the most people in the private sector, and then we can think about it later.
Yeah. It's not necessarily the right answer, but...
What do you mean? Well, you say, Mr. President, here's my answer. Oh, but it's not necessarily the right answer. He doesn't like that kind of stuff. Okay.
Is this before or after he already spent all the money?
Excuse me. What date is this? I said. This is July 2009. We're in the West Wing of the White House. He owns that office. Okay? Whose office is that, by the way? Anyone know? $150 per person can tell me whose office that is. Who?
Michelle.
So I heard Rahm's? Wrong. Peter Orszag's? It's in the West Wing. Peter Orszag's office?
Michelle Obama's?
What? Where's Peter Orszag's office? Who's Peter Orszag? What?
Director.
Say again. Who? I heard a voice here.
Mr. Orzech, the former Office of Management and Budget Director.
Yes, this is Peter Orzech sitting right there. Not his office. Where is his office? In the old executive office building across the street. All right. Homework assignment for next week. Whose office is that? We've got a bunch of kids' pictures here, a map of the world, Gene Sperling sitting there. Anyway, you'll figure it out. We'll put that up on Blackboard. I want to know whose office it is next week.
You guys still got 150?
$150.
Not Michelle Obama.
No. She's not even in the room. All right. What do you say to the president? We heard someone say, don't rock the boat, keep the exclusion. I don't want to have to be nasty here and call on people. Yeah?
I say you just won, you should rock the boat.
Okay.
But I don't know enough about it yet.
But why? Rock the boat. Let's see, it's July 2009, the boat's being rocked like hell. Let's see, the Dow is probably under 10,000 still. Unemployment is going up at 750,000 people per month. I need more headaches? And I've just spent $100 million, by the way, saying the tax exclusion, we shouldn't get rid of it because it will be the first time we're going to tax your health benefits.
I think first, kind of like the Commonwealth Fund said, is that there needs to be something in place. And that should be your first step for people.
But this is July 2009. What is the president committed to? We've already spent 6 months negotiating the damn thing. We're all for universal coverage. Yes. Do I keep the tax exclusion as part of the bill or do I not? You told them don't keep it. Why?
Well, it depends on how willing your counterparts are to compromise, I suppose.
I don't have any Republicans. This is July 2009. No Republican has come along. I'm not talking to the Republicans. I'm talking to my fellow Democrats. I have to make a key decision. Do I keep it or not?
You don't keep it because you need a way to fund universal health care. And by getting rid of the tax exclusions, you generate a lot more revenue than
for. Okay. Get rid of the tax exclusion. Get the money. We need the money. We need to pay for universal health care coverage. Get the money. Anyone else have an opinion?
I guess I'd say keep it as it is.
So the reason the president said was?
Similar to what people were saying before, I feel like you don't want to rock the boat, you've already put your status as what it is, you don't want to seem like you're wishy-washy, you say one thing to get into office, now once you're in office, you're going to change your
mind. And by the way, that argument was extremely persuasive to the president. Which is, I made a promise to the people, they elected me on this platform, and this one, I went way out, I spent $100 million telling people what I thought. For me to walk it back, right, would be a really big change. He was very serious about that, and he is very serious. One of the things that's most admirable about the guy is, this is what I said, I'm going to stick with what I said, you better come up with a really good reason for me to move off what I told the people I was going to do. And this wasn't like plank 57, right? This was $100 million spent. I think this is not something I want to do. So. You.
Yeah.
Yeah, you were in the room. There's an empty chair here, Peter Orzech. What do you tell the president?
I definitely agree with what you said.
Two-thirds of you said to get rid of the tax exclusion. Are there any Warren guys here? No? I don't want to see the same hands. All right. What do you tell the president?
I was going to say what she said. You want to finance universal health care. And at the time, it was going to be single payer. That was the plan at the time. So
you want 2009, no single payer.
Okay.
You want to finance that plan. You want the hundreds of billions of dollars to finance universal health care coverage. What do you say?
Well, I guess just continuing off of that, if you have the mandate for coverage, then it kind of does away with the cream skimming argument, so it kind of tips the scale in favor of getting, if everybody has to have it anyways, then you're not going to have an issue with, helping people not being in the pool because they don't need coverage, because they have to have it. Well,
so you would get rid of it?
Yes.
Okay, so this is a slightly different argument. So far, the people who are for getting rid of it are for getting rid of it because it's a good revenue source. This is an argument which is, look, what you're worried about is that risk pooling, that you're not getting everyone in, the healthier are going to stay out, and employer-based coverage is a good way of getting all people of different risks into the system. You can safely get rid of the employer, the tax exclusion, and even if employers drop, healthy people will still have to get coverage because of the mandate, and they'll have subsidies, and so we'll keep them in the system. Okay?
I would probably say keep it because if you have an individual mandate, there might be a perception issue with the public. So if you're requiring them to keep it and now all of a sudden employers aren't offering it, then people are not going to be happy. They're going to have to be paying more money for their own coverage.
You don't want to step out from that. So, you want to keep the public on your side if their employers start dropping because the exclusion is gone. They will get upset, even if they're going into a reasonable system. You want to minimize that. Well, what does the Affordable Care Act do in the end? It keeps the tax exclusion in place for now, but there is something which got called, in the end, the Cadillac tax on expensive insurance plans. That is a 40% excise tax on premiums above $10,200 for an individual, $27,500 for a family plan in what year? 2018. Good. So it kicked the ball down the road, but down that road it put it in place. The idea was that it would put some pressure on employers to choose less expensive plans for their workers, and consequently deliver more compensation in taxable wages. You had a point?
What do you estimate the chances are that that goes into effect in 2018?
How many people think the Cadillac tax is going to go into effect in 2018? Raise your hands. Goes into effect as written 2018. Raise your hands. Goes into effect. Hold your hands up. Hold your hand up high. We're not going to shoot you. How many people think it won't go into effect? Interesting. I'm going to answer that question in a second.
Zeke, when you were with the president, did anybody make the labor union argument with them that they were a key group and they were opposed to
it? We'll get there in a second. This, so I just want to be sure that people understand how this works. So right now, or in 2018, you have health insurance plans all over the place. And any plan that goes over $27,000 for a family of four, if it's, say, $30,000, you've got a delta here of $3,000, and the tax is 40% of that, or $1,200.
$27,500.
Right, $27,500. Okay, whatever. The math will work out. Is that clear? So you're not taxing every dollar over, and you're not linking the tax to someone's income. Now, there were a whole series of possible ways you could have structured partial, full repeal of the tax exclusion. You could have linked it to income, right? I mean, one possibility was to link it to income. Any family making over $250,000, right, we get rid of the exclusion for them, or we phase out the exclusion for them, or if you had $250,000 and you had a Cadillac plan, you'd get zero. We tax everything above. We could have done it a number of different ways. Honestly, I can't tell you why we ended up settling on this one. Seems to me crazy. We also have certain exemptions in this for high-risk employment, like firefighters. So, do I think this will go into effect as written 2018? Yes. If the president wins. Okay? If the president wins, we're going to have the Affordable Care Act fully implemented. He gets out of office January 2017. Why do I think we will not get rid of this? Two reasons. The first reason, pure politics. You cannot replace the amount of money that this exclusion raises, and you will have to replace that amount of money in a pay-go situation to keep the debt under control. Turns out this is an unbelievably great revenue generator, even at this minimal kind of funny tax, that you're excluding everything under a huge number. Turns out this is a pure money machine. And if you repeal it, you're going to have to replace the money beginning, you know, you have basically over 9 years, and there's just no way you're going to find another better revenue source. Second, I think it's going to turn out that the public is happy with the Affordable Care Act, and inflation rate will be lower than anticipated. So overall, the costs will be, you'll have fewer people actually surpassing the $27,000 mark. And I think everyone's going to say, well, you know, this has been good for cost control. Let's not rock the boat.
The devil's advocate would say, we do the doc fix every year. Right? So we, in theory, are spending a lot more money each year by putting that can down the road. And it sort of seems like anytime I see we're going to delay the pain, I work.
Well, this pain is not widely distributed. It has, so... I mean, it's not that many people who are going to be affected initially, and I think that the combination of other things and the difficulty of paying for it, and then the doc fix it, we still have to fix it in 2018, it's going to make it impossible to find the money. That would be, yeah?
I just wanted to clarify, the exemption would still be in place for income tax, but is this a separate excise tax, and who is paying the excise tax? Employer?
Actually, I'm not sure who pays it, but... I think the employer, I think it would actually be the employee ends up paying it.
But the goal is to pressure employers, so it's got to be...
Right, because, look, even if employees are paying the debt, the employers don't want to have their employees bitching and moaning it. Look, let's get clear. Right now, today, you're running the University of Pennsylvania. Do we have to pay health insurance for our workers? There's no requirement, right? The University of Pennsylvania is under no obligation today, 2012, to give anyone who works for them, Sandy or me, or any of you if you work for the University of Pennsylvania, health insurance. Zero. Why do they provide health insurance?
So they'll work somewhere else.
Yeah. They think it's a competitive advantage to attract me. You know, it's a little strange in my view. Right. If everyone's doing it, there ain't no competitive advantage to it. Right? But that's the thinking. And if suddenly I can't get these benefits, right, or I'm being taxed on it, I'm going to go and scream at them. Either they're going to have to pay me more to compensate for that tax, or they're going to have to figure something else out. Yeah?
Is the income expected to come from that 40%, or is it expected to come from employers shifting?
Excellent point. Everyone understand? Everyone hear that point? Repeat it.
Basically, is the income going to come from that 40% tax, or is it going to come from the incentive that employers may now have to shift more of the payment to income as opposed to health care?
All right. Let me... We've already covered this. We won't do this. So what was the argument I made to the president, or began making to the president in that room? He had a goal, a key goal in healthcare reform, cost control. The president has a lot of levers on cost control when it comes to public sector, Medicare and Medicaid. Right? They're public programs. Congress has to vote on them. You can structure it. There are ways of bringing the cost down.
Not to say it's painless, but you have control over that program. What's the president's levers on Aetna or WellPoint or a private company that is self-insured like the University of Pennsylvania? Virtually zero. If you're serious about cost control for the vast majority of Americans, and still most Americans get their coverage through employer-based coverage, you have a lever. It is a big, blunt, this is not surgical, lever. But your best, most effective lever, Mr. President, is the tax exclusion. And to not utilize the tax exclusion is to not use your most effective argument for the largest proportion of the population to answer the rationale you've given to get healthcare costs under control. Right? It wasn't, the president wasn't just interested in universal coverage, although he was very interested in that. He was also interested in cost control because he saw runaway healthcare costs as a threat to wages. We'll go over this later. He saw it as a threat to the federal budget, and he wanted cost control. And to leave one of your most effective arguments out of the bill seemed a mistake. And by the way, Mr. President, it's also a great revenue source, and we can help pay for it. But that was not the leading argument. That he knew about the revenue. His aides knew about the revenue, but it turned out that they had not thought through the cost control role. This meeting happened on a Friday afternoon. Began at about 3:30. It wasn't a meeting. It was actually, we didn't sit down to meet. The president was coming in to give us a congratulatory, thanks for all the hard work, pep talk. And it turned into a substantive meeting. On, I think that following Monday or Tuesday, we had three economists come into the office, the Oval Office, talk to the president about the importance of the tax exclusion as a cost control mechanism. Now, I don't know. I wasn't privileged to all the meetings with the president before. Whether it had been told to him in that way, whether he understood it and it had been told that he hadn't gotten it, hadn't been emphasized in the right way. He's a pretty smart guy, so I'm somewhat suspicious that he hadn't been explained in that way. But the importance of the tax exclusion for cost control was something that was just got its origins here and then carried on. Now, how does the tax exclusion work? And we're going to conclude in the next few minutes with that point. And this question is a very perceptive question. So, when the University of Pennsylvania decides to pay me, right, I look at what? What do I negotiate with them? I go negotiate. I'm concerned about my salary, right? So I want to know what the dollars are in the paycheck, right? But the treasurer at the University of Pennsylvania, I'm chewing up chalk. She is looking at a different number. She looks at compensation. Why is that? But she's not just paying salary to me, right? I get a check monthly, and I see the salary number. She sees salary, retirement, right? And she sees the other benefits, of which the lion's share is health insurance. From her perspective, right, my cost is not my salary. My cost is salary times 1.33. That is the number at the University of Pennsylvania to cover benefits. 33%. Now say my health insurance stays flat. This number
doesn't increase year to year, then suddenly there's more money to increase my salary. And so my take-home pay and my taxes go up. And the consequence for the federal government is not that they're going to collect all that much money from the excise tax, but it's going to be from higher income and the 35% tax they levy on the added dollars that I earn. Is that clear?
See, I think that's key.
Is that clear? This is very important. If you understand this, you're in a very, very select group of people in the country. Very few people get this point.
Hold on.
The money we raise from that Cadillac tax is predominantly increased wages. Notice that answers two of the president's concerns. Mr. President, you're interested in holding down health care costs. You've held down health care costs. Mr. President, you're interested in increasing wages. You've increased wages. And guess what? You've also increased tax receipts. This is like the trifecta. Okay, sorry. Go ahead.
You partially answered it. I was going to ask, what's the breakdown between...
Oh, the majority comes in income. It's probably 70-80%.
But Zeke, I think that's the issue. Before you had this meeting, the way economists had presented to the president was looking at the revenue solely from the excise tax and not...
No. I just think... No. So I think what you... Again, I'm hypothesizing here. Let's be very clear. This is all in Zeke's imagination. First, you had a bunch of advisors who are not economists, not health policy people, and don't get it. That's the first thing. And so they don't understand the link between the exclusion and cost control. Second, even if they understand, they see the exclusion mostly as a money machine for raising revenue. Third, they don't see the exclusion and its relationship to increased wages. And when you don't see those things, it's very hard to explain to a president those things. And even if you're the economist, you're talking at a very different plane than a very smart president about this. So you need a dumb doctor who understands explaining things at a level that, you know, his children can understand. I think it was all in the explanation. And I think that, it's not that he didn't have really smart economists. He had Larry Summers, he had Peter Orszag. He had really smart economists. He had Austin Goolsbee. Just that I don't think the communication strategy on this particular issue was clear. But I could be wrong. Could have been, it was a beautiful Friday, he was suddenly open to the issue. All I can tell you is that right after that, we had a whole series of meetings about it, and we had a flip in our position. Any other questions?
Just to review again, where is the increase in salary coming from in relation to the 40% tax? We're just saying salary is going to increase.
Legislation can't say salary is going to increase. But employers, so if you're an employer, anyone here ever been an employer? Yeah, this is a problem. So if you're an employer, you look at total compensation. The issue with total compensation is benefits. If you look at benefits, the thing which drives benefits is not retirement. It's not disability, right? It's all health care. Okay, it's not the tuition benefit here at Penn, because while that goes up faster than even healthcare, the fact is not that many people take it, so it's a point. So the big thing driving your benefit side is health insurance.
That goes up inexorably year to year, way above inflation. Okay? If suddenly you're capping that, you're not going to increase over this 27,500 because you don't want the tax, your employees don't want that, right? You're suddenly going to, you're going to go to your insurer and say, look, you give me a product that satisfies the law and it's 27,500, I'm not taking a nickel over it, okay? Employer does whatever he or she needs to do to satisfy the law and to get to 27,500. Then the employer says, I can increase wages, right? I can be generous to my workers, they can now see wage increases. Increase the salary $5,000, 35% of that goes to Uncle Sam. Uncle Sam sees increase in tax receipts, I see an increase in my take-home pay. Everybody is happy. Except who? Insurance companies, do they keep that money? The healthcare system suddenly is under cost control pressure to keep costs down somehow. We'll talk about that in the second half of the course, where all that savings is going to come from. But from a perspective, at the presidential level, he's not thinking, well, you know, how a doctor's going to live and how not. He sees, oh, we've got a cost control lever, and by the way, I've also seen an increase in wages and increase in taxes to finance my program. Everybody turns out to be better off this way. And then if you can say, by the way, it's a regressive benefit, blah, 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 you have a lot of good targets. All right, thank you. We'll see you next Tuesday.
You can just hit the record button.